Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Natural gas prices rise in Europe as Ukraine limits Russian supplies, plus a new offshore wind auction spotlights the challenges of greening the U.S. grid. And Shanghai's COVID-19 lockdowns leave thousands sleeping in the streets.
Because there's such a stigma around having a heightened COVID risk, a lot of residential compounds have disallowed food delivery workers from coming back into their homes once they've left.
It's Wednesday, May 11th. I'm Luke Vargas with The Wall Street Journal. Here's the AM edition of What's News, the top headlines and business stories moving your world today. Natural gas prices in Europe have increased today after Ukraine said it would reduce flows from Russia through part of the eastern Luhansk region. Ukraine's pipeline operator claimed Russian troops were interfering with gas pipeline infrastructure there, including by siphoning off gas. WSJ reporter Joe Wallace has more on the initial market reaction.
Prices in Europe for natural gas were up about 5%. More muted than one might expect. And the reason for that is that a sufficient amount appears to be flowing for European companies that buy gas from Russia to get all the gas they need.
A spokeswoman for Gazprom PJSC, Russia's giant gas supplier, didn't immediately respond to a request for comment. U.S. House lawmakers have passed legislation that would send $40 billion in emergency aid to Ukraine and U.S. allies in the region. But objections to the bill by Senate Republicans could slow its progress to President Joe Biden's desk, as some of them have expressed wariness about spending more money without further oversight. The U.S. Senate has voted to confirm economist Lisa Cook to the Federal Reserve, making her the first black woman to sit on the central bank's board. Cook is the second of President Biden's Fed nominees to win Senate confirmation. Results from Republican primary elections in two U.S. states have yielded mixed results for former President Donald Trump. In West Virginia, Trump-backed Representative Alex Mooney beat Representative David McKinley, while in Nebraska, Governor hopeful Charles Herbster, who received Trump's endorsement, lost to Jim Pillen. China has reported rising inflation in April, with consumer prices climbing 2.1% from a year earlier. Though Chinese consumer inflation is now at a five-month high, the price increases remain modest by global standards. Journal reporter Stella Yifan Shia says China's inflation also has different root causes than that seen elsewhere.
The rise of inflationary pressure was more caused by the supply shortage rather than overheating demand, as we've seen in many countries in the West. The zero COVID policy has caused major disruptions to the country's logistics network and its manufacturing capacity. Companies are holding back new investments, and consumer spending has been fairly depressed.
We'll have more on how pandemic lockdowns in the city of Shanghai continue to affect that city's population later in the show. And Shireen Abu Akla, a veteran Palestinian-American reporter for the Al Jazeera News Network, was shot and killed earlier today during an Israeli military raid into the West Bank city of Jenin. Palestinian officials blamed Israeli forces for Abu Akla's killing, while Israel said its information indicated Palestinian militants were responsible. The Biden administration will today begin an auction of more than 100,000 acres of East Coast seabed, roughly eight times the size of Manhattan, to offshore wind farm developers. However, the project faces opposition from the local fishing industry, leading officials to pledge to compensate businesses for losses, even though the details haven't yet been worked out. WSJ Energy reporter Jennifer Hiller is here with the latest on how climate policy is colliding with the livelihood of coastal businesses via this sale. Jennifer, thank you for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
All right, so what is the administration auctioning off here exactly, and how consequential of an auction is this?
So this is going to be an auction off of the Carolinas, and it's going to open up a new part of the East Coast offshore wind. It's going to give us a little bit more information on how interested companies are in developing this new industry for the U.S., and it's sort of a key part of President Biden's climate plans. He wants to see a lot of offshore wind projects by 2030, and we just have a couple of them right now. It's a fairly large sale. It's 110,000 acres. It's not expected to fetch the kind of prices that the recent sale off of New York and New Jersey did, though. That was a record-setting more than $4 billion that came in for that auction. I think it will fetch probably a pretty good price, but it's not expected to go for that kind of dollar value.
And you report it is not all smooth sailing around this auction. What pushback is the administration facing?
So as in other parts of the East Coast, this auction is running into some opposition from the local fishing community, and that includes both commercial fishermen and people who run recreational charter fishing boats. Some of the charter boat operators are particularly concerned about this. There's some hard bottom reef off of the Carolinas that attracts lots of fish, turtles, whales, tropical fish even. And they're concerned about damage to the reef that could happen. They're worried about what happens during construction and installation. And they just feel like they don't have a good understanding of what's going to be happening out in the ocean and how it might affect the marine life. But broadly speaking, I think offshore wind is facing opposition from locals in different ways. And renewables are running into the same kind of pushback from local residents that in many ways oil and gas has been dealing with for decades.
That was WSJ Energy reporter Jennifer Hiller. Jennifer, thanks as always for the update.
Thank you.
Coming up, COVID-19 lockdowns in Shanghai have kept tens of millions of residents trapped indoors for a month and a half, but they are also leaving thousands homeless. We'll have that story after the break.
This message comes from Viking, committed to exploring the world in comfort. Journey through the heart of Europe on an elegant Viking longship with thoughtful service, destination-focused dining, and cultural enrichment on board and on shore. And every Viking voyage is all-inclusive with no children and no casinos. Discover more at Viking.com.
A month and a half of lockdowns in China's wealthiest city, Shanghai, have left most residents trapped inside their homes. But thousands of others, including essential delivery drivers, are now facing the opposite predicament, living on the streets as they wrestle with the choice of being locked out of their homes with a job or locked in without one. WSJ China tech and society reporter Karen Hao joins us now with more. Karen, welcome. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
So Shanghai's COVID lockdowns are now in their sixth week. And as you report, they're not just causing people to be unable to leave their homes to go to jobs or out to shop for groceries, but people are being turned homeless because they can't return to their residences. What is going on here?
Yeah, it's sort of a really sad irony that the same stringent COVID rules that aren't allowing people to come out of their homes are the same ones that are then preventing people from going back into their homes. And there's a variety of reasons for why this is happening, and a variety of different types of people that this is happening to. But primarily, the hardest hit are migrant workers. They come from rural areas or smaller cities for better economic opportunity. And what's happened is some of them came with specific companies that offered them food and housing. It was sort of an all-inclusive deal. And when the lockdown shut down, the company shut down those worker dorms. And so now these migrant workers are on the street. But there's also a subset of migrant workers who actually have almost chosen to live on the street because it's the only way that they can earn income. So this is specifically migrant workers that have turned to food delivery work, which is one of the only things that you can do now and have exemption to get out of lockdown. But the problem is because there's such a stigma around having a heightened COVID risk, a lot of residential compounds themselves have disallowed these food delivery workers from coming back into their homes once they've left. These workers, they do have access to certain limited hotels, but they told me that it is
really hard to navigate this system of finding hotels that even allow them to stay. And so many of them who don't have friends, don't have connections because they literally arrived in Shanghai weeks or months before everything shut down, are now living in tents and living under bridges with blankets and bed sheets as the only protection from the elements.
Karen, you spoke to some people who've been affected by all of this. What do they say about the lockdown policy in Shanghai and the predicament they find themselves in?
You know, it's really interesting. Speaking with the food delivery workers, there is actually quite a mixed reaction. Some of them feel very entrepreneurial about it. And in fact, there are certain social media platforms that are really common among the working class, the blue collar workers. And when you scroll through, there are a lot of food delivery driver influencers that talk about how great their life is on the street and how they're like making a lot of money. But of course, the overwhelming number of people have been deeply frustrated. They feel like they're falling through the cracks of this system. Government regulation technically says they should be allowed to live back home, but the residential compounds just don't care. They technically should be given more support for their own meals because they're the ones that are delivering other people's meals. And yet many of them have had to rely on food donations from volunteers and things like that to eat. And so they feel very spurned, I guess, by this system that just has clearly not taken their needs into consideration.
And how do those sentiments compare with how residents of Shanghai more broadly are viewing these pandemic measures overall?
It's also similarly mixed, and it really depends on your socioeconomic status. So people at lower rungs that don't have fridges filled to the brim with food or are living in districts that are well provided for by government rations, they're the ones that are the most deeply frustrated. And there have been social media videos of them like screaming, of people getting into fights because they've really been pushed to the brink of their sanity in terms of what they've been able to go through. But then on the flip side, there are quite a lot of wealthier Shanghai residents. And to keep in mind, Shanghai is the wealthiest city in China, that have actually enjoyed lockdown because they're allowed to just like be at peace in their own homes.
And finally, Karen, what has the Chinese government's response been, both in the city of Shanghai and more broadly, to some of the frustration over its pandemic measures?
The government has basically just doubled down on their zero COVID policy. They have just continued reminding people that this is what it takes to keep the entire country in a relatively reasonable state. And in fact, they've been reminding people this is what it takes to not be like the U.S. and have so many COVID deaths from just letting the virus go rampant.
That was WSJ China Tech and Society reporter Karen Hao. Karen, thank you for bringing us this story.
Thank you so much for having me.
And finally, Wednesday has long been known in the office as Hump Day, but it's increasingly becoming Office Day Wednesday as businesses try to drum up some midweek excitement to get people back into the office. WSJ real estate reporter Peter Grant explains that while some businesses are using Whiskey Wednesdays with the boss or Bring Your Pup to Work Woof Wednesdays to lure employees back, it's workers that are in the driver's seat.
Employers are saying, we want you to come to work 3 days a week. And they're getting some pushback from workers saying, okay, we can do 3 days, but we want it to be three consecutive days so we can take longer weekends. And employees have a lot of bargaining power because of the labor shortage. So employers are going along with that. And so the common denominator is going to be Wednesday.
And that's What's News for Office Day Wednesday morning. We'll be back tonight with a new show. I'm Luke Vargas with The Wall Street Journal. Thanks for listening.